Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm La. So I guess there's some D&D news.
Yeah, that's right. So as of today, as of this recording, old editions of D&D modules and supplemental rules and stuff like that are available via PDF.
How cool is that?
I thought that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, it was posted on Facebook, and I was the first like on that.
You're like, first!
I didn't do that. And I clicked on the link, and I could actually access the website, which is, I guess, a separate but affiliated DriveThruRPG website.
Oh, wow.
And then I guess so many people... And I got about two pages in, and then it just crashed.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody just flooded it and crashed it, but I think I was one of the first people
to check
it out. It looked pretty good. There's some a lot of modules. I only got up to
second
C
page.
Or C or D.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that they've got the other ones as well. And there's some things from 4th edition, 3rd edition.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty exciting.
Oh, that's really cool.
The other thing I noticed on there is D&D Redbox from 1981 is going for $4.99.
Yeah, the prices were very reasonable,
wow,
which is important.
Oh, I might have picked that up. I have such fond memories of the Redbox.
I remember when we were talking about D&D Next and, you know, Wizards comes out and says that they're going to, or there's going to be like a 2-year wait before, you know, D&D Next is actually on the shelves. And we're thinking about, like, well, what are they going to do to generate revenue during that time? That's still 2 years. And, you know, could their magic cards and could other sales carry them? But I think they're probably going to make a lot of money with this because they don't have to pay any printing or layout cost. You know, the amount of money they have to put into doing this was pretty minimal.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure people were going to, like, snap up modules and all kinds of rule stuff. So
yeah, totally.
Pretty smart move on their part.
Absolutely. And it's a good answer to Paizo and things like that, because that's D&D's strength, is they have such a huge catalog of things to offer.
Yeah, I was wondering, like, are they... I haven't seen a lot, apart from the Red Bucks, I haven't seen a lot of, like, core rules on there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if they're going to keep those off to encourage people to buy modules to use with their system of choice, whether it's, like, a previous version of D&D or to try it with D&D Next, because... Mm-hmm. I mean, again, no idea if this is true or not, but as soon as you put out, like, the core rules, then why not just play that one that you like so much?
Right, right.
But...
Yes and no. I know we talked about this today, and that's when you said they were putting up no rules, and you told me about somebody else's theory, which was to encourage people to buy modules because they would somehow see the rules as a limitation.
Right.
Like kind of as an entry. And I thought, no, it's to... kind of get rid of the D&D schism that's going
on.
Right. To kind of get rid of the other editions and focus on the whatever is the most recent one or the current one. But then they have done the reprints of the first edition books and the reprints of the third edition books. So we may see them come up, but I don't know.
Yeah. Do you guys know, is 4E still supported? Are they still producing stuff? I haven't looked in the longest time.
I don't think they're actually producing anything for 4E, but on the other hand, like, I don't think Wizards has put out an official announcement saying 4E is dead or we're not going to support it.
Mm.
I think it's just kind of been, and again, maybe I'm wrong, I think it's just kind of been silence on Wizards' part.
Well, I don't know if you mentioned it on the podcast, Wayne, but you certainly were talking about it before, and just the way they promoted, I guess, the last couple releases that they had, where they were saying that it can be used with any system and everything.
Right, right.
They're very much playing up the fluff and downplaying the system.
Mm-hmm. Right.
To encourage people, of course, to buy it and thinking that they could then use it with D&D Next.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. The one that springs to mind is Menza Barrands and the sort of the Dark Elf source book. And even though it looked like a 4th edition book, you know, just kind of like the style of the cover and the way everything was laid out and... But, yeah, it was not a 4th edition book. As Lyle said, it was just kind of system neutral.
Huh. Interesting.
I mean, not 100% system neutral, but still D&D, you know. But, yeah, it was an attempt And I wonder if they did that from the beginning of its conception, or whether it was kind of not really a last-minute scramble, but kind of like whether they had already worked on it for a while before, you know, the news came down the pipe of, well, 4E is getting shelved, we're doing D&D next, cut out all 4E mechanics and make this as, you know, system-neutral as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder how that worked for them.
From the art direction, I would say it was the latter.
I suspect you're right, yeah.
Mm.
It was in the pipeline, and then they decided that, okay, we know what's going to happen. It's kind of like, you know, the cannibalization.
Right.
We've announced it. People are just going to hold their money, and that's going to cut into our sales of the current edition. So let's try to make this as edition neutral as possible.
Right.
And also, we're not seeing a lot of follow-up of some other stuff to get us excited.
Mm.
So this is what they've done now is a great stopgap. I think there'll be a huge flurry, and then, you know, the excitement will die down.
Right.
But I think people are just going to fill in the gaps in their collection.
Right. Like, I imagine there would be some, like, I don't think it's going to completely go down to, like, nothing. I imagine there still will be some trickle of activity, because people that came into D&D via 4E or third edition, like, as you said, Lyle, they might not have a lot of these modules or books, and they'll still be interested to see what came before, and, you know, maybe they'll buy a title here or there to convert over to whatever system they're playing. But
yeah.
I suspect you're right. There'll be like a big activity at the beginning, and then it'll kind of taper off. So I wonder
how difficult it would be to just do straight up conversions. Because I know they've done updates. Like I have some of the Expedition series that came out at the end of 3.5, and they're excellent products. But they're very much updates on the modules that they're representing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you just did a straight up conversion, which would just be you're kind of statting out things.
Right.
And I know that might not be terribly difficult for experienced DM, but for a lot of DMs, they might appreciate buying a $5 4D product or a $5 3.5 product.
Mm-hmm.
That's an update of a first edition product.
Mm.
If they did that with, say, for example, 5E, and we were playing 5E, sorry, D&D Next, if we were playing on a regular basis, I'd definitely go for some converted modules. That's absolutely. Especially, actually, with some of the older systems, whatever my preferred system is, there's a few, especially 4E, just doesn't translate very well. So it'd be hard to like rebuild all the monsters from another edition into 4E or vice versa. So, yeah, I'd definitely like something like that.
I wonder if even if you would have to, like, convert stuff over. I mean, could you just do, like, a quick and dirty? Well, it says there should be, like, 3 orcs and a bugbear chieftain, so I'll use whatever entry from whatever version of the monster's manual I'm using.
That's a great point, yeah. Work. Yeah, that's.
It may, but it may not, because, I mean, you look at how many hit points or how difficult it was to kill a PC in 4th edition compared to someone in 3 or 3.5. And, yeah, the math might be off. To what extent, I don't know. Maybe to the point where things don't work. But it may just be a simple thing of, you know, flipping open whatever, monstrous menu you want to use and filling stuff in. So.
Mm-hmm.
And on to another gaming topic, and this one's Fate. And I was watching Spartacus last night, and remember we were talking about with Fate, we're talking about the environmental aspects, and I had some issues with that. One of the issues was, you know, if you say, I hide in the tall grass, you know, you apply the aspect to the environment,
mm-hmm.
and I don't pay the upkeep, then suddenly the tall grass becomes short grass or something like that.
It gets mowed away, right.
Yeah, in mid-combat. And I was watching this episode, and they had a scene that kind of reminded me of environmental aspects and how they can come and go between the rounds. And not that it doesn't give too much away, but there's a locked grate or locked door, but you can... It's got bars. It's not like a solid door.
It's almost like an old-time jail door.
Yeah.
You know, you can, like, reach through it and stuff.
So I guess when we were talking about environmental aspects, one of the problems was if the game master says, well, there's a grate in front of you, and it's locked, and you go, well, no, it isn't. It's unlocked. And you don't pay the upkeep, suddenly it becomes locked, right?
Mm-hmm.
How does that make sense?
It's magic.
Then it was... Well, yeah, it's magic, yeah. But then just watching that... what was happening in Spartacus, then you could say the environmental aspect isn't that it's unlocked, it's that, oh, a guard just walked by with the keys.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can access the guard because he's just right on the other side, but it's not a solid door.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you're doing is applying the environmental aspect to create the possibility of an unlocked door. You know, trying to get that key. And maybe you fail, so if you don't pay the upkeep, you don't have the key anymore. It leaves with the guard.
Well, that's kind of the point of the whole aspect idea. I mean that you create this environmental advantage for you, and you gain the advantage. And at the time, you may be modifying the environment, but it's the advantage that can slip away without the upkeep. For example, in the tall grass, if somebody's shooting at you, and you duck behind some tall grass, that's great. But if you don't pay the upkeep to keep within the tall grass something, the other person maybe can maneuver around behind you to where you no longer have the cover of the tall grass.
Right. I think, and we've mentioned this before, so I won't dwell on it, but I think, yeah, that requires a shift of perspective from what we're used to in traditional games, where once you establish something, it's kind of always there. So, yeah, I think you do have to narrate stuff a lot more with those environmental aspects in Fate. And I think for us it was just difficult to wrap our head around. It's like, well, I made tall grass. Doesn't it hang around? Or the other one was someone took cover behind the car. And mm-hmm. It's like, okay, I have cover. But you didn't pay it again. And yeah, I think you really... Both the player has to be aware that this is going to happen, and the game master has to really narrate why that thing no longer provides the benefit or the advantage it did. And that example in Spartacus is a good one where, yeah, the door isn't unlocked. You just now have fleeting access to the key to unlock the door. Because honestly, like, some things are going to be easier to narrate away than others.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, the tall grass, well, we joked, like, did it get mowed during combat? Well, no, you know, it's still there. But, yeah, the game master would have to narrate. Well, maybe he got, the opponent got up on top of a car or now has high ground where that doesn't provide the cover it once did.
Yeah.
Still, I like the idea, yeah, giving yourself access to something or the possibility of gaining access rather than just straight up getting it.
Yeah, that's the point, is that I think, and maybe this was just us and other people with Fate more savvy with the environmental aspects, but yeah, it's not like the door's locked and you're like, no, it's not. Hey, I just played my aspect. But very similar to Mage, where you need to be very creative with your spheres in order to create what is a magical effect, but it's not a magical effect, so you don't trigger the paradox.
Hmm.
Where it's like, it's gotta be plausible, but you're not necessarily bending reality, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Or maybe it's just a case of you cannot counter something that's already been established. The GM says the door is locked, but you can't just invoke an aspect and say, no, it's unlocked. You have to invoke an aspect that says, oh, well, you know, I can somehow get the key to unlock the door.
It's not like, okay, there's a wall, and it's got a hole. Oh, yeah. Why didn't they patch that up, kind of thing? But it's
because
like,
they had
well,
the
it
aspect
had
of stupid.
But no, they did patch it up, and maybe there was, you know, somebody did punch a hole through the wall or something.
I think,
but
it's
they patched it up, and
I think it's kind of got the same shortfalls that Mage also suffers. Is that it has the freedom of a really open system, but part of the freedom is that it can be misused and abused by players. I remember an example I heard on another podcast before is, if you're in a city and playing Mage, then it's always feasible that there's a gas main running underneath wherever your target is. So, oh look, a gas main exploded when you just cast Fireball.
Yeah, it's just lazy playing though.
Exactly, but I mean, I think that's kind of the same thing, is that both the GM and the players really have to be on board to what that kind of system is in order for it to work well.
Yeah.
All right. All right, for the main topic for this episode, we're going to be talking about Tokyo, and it's actually going to be our first city installment for Locale. And we wanted to give our city installments a kind of a special flavor, a special format, so we're trying something new. It may seem like we've just, you know, wrapped an old format, new paper, but we'll see how it goes.
Maybe we did.
Just like a fish.
Well, hopefully it won't stink.
Well done, Wade.
Hey, they re-gifted Gladiators.
Called it Tokyo? How does that work?
They're slaves to the 9-to-5. I don't know.
Actually, you guys ever see a bit of a tangent? You guys ever watch that show Cool Japan?
Nope.
Oh, it's like a panel of foreigners, and they talk about aspects of Japanese culture or life, and then they kind of have people rate whether it's cool or not. But it's decent than most other kind of reality shows on Japanese TV, in that the people in the panel will actually speak their mind, and so you hear like negative opinions and stuff. And one of them was about punctuality. You know, supposedly like that people in Japan are always kind of, you know, always on time and punctual. And one of the guys brought up, like, well, no, I don't really think that's true, because nobody follows the work clock out time. You know, they just keep working until things are done. And if they were really sort of slaves to time and always on schedule, as soon as 5 o'clock came, they would clock out and go home. And that never happens.
I want to argue with that, but I don't know how.
Yeah, it's actually a pretty decent show.
Sounds worth checking out.
And we can cut this. But the other one that I saw was they had kind of like a paper doll.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked people to dress it in like a skirt of varying lengths and various necklines. And of course, all the Japanese people, and again, this might have been editing, picked the high neckline short skirt,
mm-hmm.
where a lot of the foreigners, they asked, picked the low neckline thing. And they discussed, you know, kind of why it was acceptable in certain cultures to, you know, expose cleavage, whereas that doesn't really happen in Japan.
Because lack thereof?
Well, that's what one of the guys brought up, you know, and he did it tactfully. So it's kind of why I like that show, because the people will actually speak their mind rather than just the, oh, great. But anyway.
My parents, when they came down, when they got married, it's one of the first things they pointed out. And they go, we noticed that the women wear different shirts over here.
Yeah. Different shorts, for that matter, too.
Shorts?
Yeah, totally. Like, the amount of leg that Japanese women show, it would be pretty surprising to a lot of Americans, I reckon.
I guess, yeah. Anyway, for our format here, what we decided to do is we'll see if we're going to divide the cities into four broad categories. Population, power, culture, and landscapes. And we'll be looking at the things in each category that we think are special about the particular city. And of course, these things are things that you can use in your game. Okay, we don't know how long this is going to run, so it might be a two-part episode. And if at the point in the episode we say, hey, it's going to be a two-part episode, then you'll know.
By that very admission.
Cool. So the first category we'll be talking about is population.
Yeah, I think that's kind of in my opinion, an obvious one for Tokyo. Just because...
There's a lot.
Yeah, exactly. The population is absolutely massive.
I remember reading before that it was the most populous metropolis in the world, or has China surpassed that?
From what I read, it might be out of date, yeah, it was still the most populous metropolis in the world. But I also read that it's very difficult to exactly nail down what exactly constitutes a metropolis, so...
Mm-hmm. That was one of those things where it empties out at night and then fills back up in the morning kind of thing.
Yeah.
Mm. It doesn't really empty out. It's not like it's a ghost town. It's not like, what is it? There's a city in the States.
There's several.
Like, yeah, there's a city in Florida where they filmed The Last Punisher.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently it just totally empties out when it's...
Because of that movie?
Not working out yet.
No, but I don't know. I read that too, and they called it like a bed town. Or no, they didn't call Tokyo the bed town. Bed town is kind of the same thing as like a commuter town.
Chiba is which is an entire prefecture. But that would be like a bedroom community where that people don't work there. They live there.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, and yeah, it's not like saying like nobody lives or sleeps in Tokyo. But like I forget exactly what areas, but the population during the day was some insane number. And, you know, then the population at night is barely like 10% of that, just because so many people go there just to work. And then that's all it is. It's kind of like offices. And then they go home to wherever they commute to. So
with that in mind, I think one of the key aspects is dense. It's a really dense city in terms of people. So when you set a game here, I think that's something that you really have to factor in, and you have to factor in always.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In that, it's really tough to be alone in the city. I mean, to such an extent, I mean, they have these things called love hotels, which would be the equivalent in North America of a no-tell motel.
Yeah, I was thinking pay-by-the-hour motel. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
With Santa Claus themes.
Yeah, they do have themes.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, part of it is just because it's so dense, but also it's dense in their own apartment.
Right.
And, of course, there's the seedy side because it's dense because your wife and kids are in the apartment. But, I mean, that's just something to factor in. I mean, you go to these karaoke boxes, and you can imagine that these boxes are very loud and noisy. But that's also, in a sense, your time away from the rest of the city.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And go on this, but even on the train, and something that may be very difficult to grasp is people are so good at shutting out the stuff around them.
Yeah.
So people would be picking their nose or making funny noises or doing their makeup, and it's almost as if they've dropped like this, you know, invisible cone around them where no one can see them or hear them or anything.
No, I remember when I was still teaching, some of the horror stories I would hear from students, especially like high school girls, about stuff that had happened to them on an absolutely packed commuter train and nobody did anything. I remember one girl said that, you know, she was sitting on one of those bench seats and the guy in front of her literally exposed himself, you know, because when you stand on one of those things, the person sitting on the bench in front of you is kind of at crotch height, and nobody did anything. And it's not like she was on the train by herself. You know, she was like packed in the seat next to people. And you're absolutely right that people do kind of have a their own little world just because it is so dense and there's so many other people around. And you kind of have to do that to have any peace of mind sometimes. It's kind of scary.
Yeah, and it's not like it's it is more crowded in some places than others, but just the consistency of the density. It's like everywhere you go, you just can't escape people.
Yeah. And it always gets worse. It never gets better. You know, if you go on to the train at rush hour, I'm sure everybody's seen the pictures on the internet with the train conductors with these big paddles where they just shove people into the cars like a can of sardines. And granted, you know, you can get out of the car and get back onto the street, but it never empties out. You never have space. There's people everywhere.
I'll disagree with that. Not always. Sometimes you miss your stop just because you cannot physically get off of the train enough. And
so true. Very true.
I don't think anyone who hasn't experienced that can really understand what it feels like to be packed onto one of those train cars like a sardine. I mean, literally, you actually get smashed up against the walls and windows of the train.
Yeah, when the train starts to get out of the central city area for it, they'll have conductors go into the trains to pick up people who've fainted, because there's so many people packed in. People will faint and they'll stay standing because they just can't fall over.
Yeah,
and I think that's something that when you play a game and you're establishing a city setting and you're trying to convey like it's crowded, but still the players are able to move pretty much free within that environment. Like, there's a lot of stuff going on around them, and you might have set things up very well with some sort of text or whatever. But just to, like, you just can't walk in a straight line.
No.
You know, and that's one thing to incorporate into your game to really try to sell the density of Tokyo, is that people are in your way, but they're not in your way in a sense. Because, I mean, you're both surrounded by millions, but then you're alone. And, you know, just moving from point A to point B can be difficult in the fact that you need to move through so many different people.
Mm-hmm.
And what can happen there. And actually Wayne's anecdote, well, not his anecdote, but conveying somebody else's anecdote of the exposure. I mean, do the players see that? Do they do anything about that? Do they care? I mean, the jeopardization, you know? Because you're going to see a million stories walking from one place to another.
Yeah.
So it's a great sandbox, you just can't move in it. I guess a quick sandbox? I don't know.
New gaming term, yeah. Tokyo was the
quick
sandbox.
Yeah, I just came up with that.
Patent!
Alright, the next category for our cities is power. And I think Tokyo actually offers a pretty unique example of power. Wayne, you were talking about that before the episode.
Yeah, I guess my theory kind of got debunked, but in coming up with what we were going to talk about for this episode, I thought Tokyo felt kind of special because everything is centered in this city. Like, Tokyo holds, you know, the government buildings for Japan. It's also one of the, if not the largest, or has the highest GDP of any metro area. So you have like this enormous economic power centered in Tokyo. And also it's the home of the emperor. And in both kind of a secular and a religious sense, it's the spiritual center of Japan. So here you have religious, economic, and political power all centered in this one city for an entire nation. And yeah, I just think that's, well, I was going to say really cool, but yeah, that's a tremendous amount of power centered in one city for good or ill.
I just thought of London.
Yeah. Like I said, my theory kind of got debunked before the episode as we were discussing this, but I still think that's the first thing that kind of popped into my head when we were going to do this episode. And yeah, there might be other cities like that, but I would argue maybe not to the extent of Tokyo.
I think, yeah, just the power that it's exerted, and for people who are perhaps from the States, might have a bit of trouble understanding, because the States have a lot of power in the United States. But if you're in a country which has a very, very strong federal government, then that gives you a good example of just how much power Tokyo has, and it pretty much dictates a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the differences in the other areas of Japan are pretty superficial.
Mm-hmm.
Now, spiritually, yeah, I suppose the emperor is kind of the spiritual center, but it's not as religious as some countries.
No, it certainly isn't. And that's why I said it's sort of secular as well, because, I don't know, it's kind of difficult to classify as religion, because I read something where, you know, some textbooks will say that like 80 to 90% of Japan follow the Shinto religion. But then you actually ask Japanese people, and maybe like only like 40 to 50% of them say they actually follow, you know, the religion, or a lot of them say they're non-religious. But in that sense, yeah, it's not really the spiritual head, but I don't know, the fact that the emperor lives there, and the emperor is kind of the symbol of Japan in a way that's different than, say, you know, the president of the United States or the prime minister of Australia. They kind of represent, the emperor of Japan kind of represents the spirit of the people of Japan. So even in a secular way, I still think you have an incredibly powerful, if not really all that powerful in fact, symbol right there in Tokyo.
If you're more familiar with Western tradition, it's not that dissimilar with England, in that there's a figurehead of the state, the Queen, who is also the head of the Church of England. But then there's also kind of a separate political power base. But it is looked to a little bit differently in Japan. Even though he doesn't really have any power, the people still look on the emperor with a lot of reverence, more so than any British people that I've met look on the Queen.
Well, that might be just because a lot of them are expats.
This is very true, yeah. And, you know, another part of this power all being centralized in one place is, you know, you talk about the halls of power, and it's really true, because you have the people who are running the country, the diet, the politicians, and they're, you know, just down the block from all of the heads of business, all the bank managers and everything like that. All of the largest corporations, if they don't have their headquarters in Tokyo, they at least have their second or largest office in Tokyo. And everything is so close to each other, it's really easy to, for, you know, the people to go shake hands, have lunch, make deals. If for an American perspective on it, you know, you can say that Washington has ties to New York bankers, but, you know, they still have to take a flight to go and talk to them, or by phone, I suppose. But it's quite different when they're literally right next door to each other.
Yeah, I read that Tokyo has 51 of the global 500 companies based there, which is more than double the next city.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And, like, even though, you know, kind of tenuous link here, when we're talking about power, I couldn't help but think of Shadowrun. And, like, hear me out on this analogy, but, you mm-hmm. know, Shadowrun has those, like, megacorps, and when you go up against a megacorp, that means that they have immense power and wealth at their disposal. Mm-hmm. And they're going to use that to get you. And that's the kind of power I think about. And I'm not really sure how you would represent that, but that's the power I think about when you're talking about economic power for Tokyo. You know, there's a reason why all these companies are there, and that's where all this money is centered.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you'd say the mega corporations, like any kind of cyberpunk genre or like Shadowrun, you said, the Zaibatsu is a big part of it. And for anyone who's not familiar with the term, it's basically like a monopoly, but where they control all aspects of production and sales of the business, and it's just a huge, huge company.
Yeah, I was thinking like extending that to any kind of genre or type of game that you set in Tokyo. And Shadowrun was just the example that popped up, but I'm not exactly sure how you would do it, but I would definitely try and show that power in whatever story you ran in mm-hmm. Tokyo.
This, you know, political connotations and opinions aside, it's very easy to paint Tokyo or just the power system of Japan as being a very corrupt organization. So play with it. Have fun.
Yeah, but do it. Yeah. Yeah. And not only like headquarters of just Japanese companies, but foreign companies are there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if your game is going to have like a foreign company, you're going to be in Tokyo.
Right.
If your game has movers and shakers, there's no point going outside of Tokyo.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because you got to have to do the moving and shaking in Tokyo. So, as far as power goes, if you're going to give it an element, it would be like central or mover and shaker. I mean, that's it. It's not like America where there are different capitals.
Right.
There's a financial capital. There's an entertainment capital. There is a political capital. Yep. And by entertainment, that would be America's spiritual capital. Ha!
So,
and for that matter,
you're looking at Nevada?
No, I was thinking Los Angeles.
Oh, all right. I was thinking legal prostitution. All right.
I guess.
It all depends on what you define as entertainment. But for that matter, it's also markets as well. You know, if you're in a company in New York, you might have to worry about, you know, what California, what's going on there, what are the fashions now. But in Japan, you don't have to care. People in Tokyo can be forgiven for being arrogant about their position because it's really the only city that matters for business.
Right.
No, that's an excellent. Yeah, it's also the cultural capital,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a good segue into our next heading, and that is culture.
Oh, shocker.
Was it going to be capital?
One of those two.
And I think one of the elements which could have been population, but one of the elements that we put into culture is homogeny. So at least as far as ethnicity goes, Tokyo is very homogenous.
As much of Japan.
Yeah, as much as
Japan. Yeah, I think it's less than 1% are non-Japanese.
But also, I think the homogeny thing kind of gets into, or ties back to economic power a little bit in that, yeah, that's where all these, as we said, these big headquarters are. And so, like, going to work here in Osaka, the trains are packed with either high school kids wearing the uniform or businessmen in their dark suits. And I almost can't imagine what it would be like in Tokyo to go during rush hour and to see the crosswalk absolutely full of a sea of black suited businessmen. Like, if you could get an aerial shot of like a major thoroughfare, I'm sure that's literally what it would look like.
Actually, another plus for having more women in the workforce, and that is that they don't necessarily follow the black. So it adds a splash of color to that sea.
And really, that's why we fight for equality.
Right. Not about the equal pay, not about, you know, raising the birth rate, nothing like that. I'm tired of looking at the sea of black suited businessmen when I go to work every day. Right.
But you know they do? They're still like kind of constricted to like the two colors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And man, what's with the white shirts?
Oh, it's impossible to buy any other color of a shirt here. You either got blue stripes or white. And that's it.
If it's any consolation, you have a body size and shape that can still buy shirts.
But you know something, what's interesting, I mean, sure, there is a lot of homogeny, and probably in spite of this, then there's a lot of breakouts and very, very, like, niche cultures.
Mm-hmm. I'd say because of.
Mm-hmm. In spite of, yeah, in spite of it, because of, yeah. No, you're right, because of that. And you know, they say you can find just about anything in Tokyo, and this is true.
He knows.
Hey, I'm not the one who talked about Nevada earlier.
I was thinking about what you said about, yeah, the cultures, and I can't say whether it's despite of or because of, but one thing that's definite is it is more noticeable, you know, because most of the city goes are kind of like homogenous. When you do see that, you know, gothic Lolita fashion or like the super tanned, you know, Gyaru style girls, that really does stand out because, hey, everyone else around them looks almost similar or very normal.
I think that's kind of the point of it. It's a reaction to the strength of the homogeny in the culture there. And it, in addition to, as we talked before, the enormous population where, man, it doesn't matter how you look, you're still just a face in the crowd. So it's a way to differentiate yourself. And there's, I mean, I'm sure most people have seen cosplay and things online like this. And yeah, it's some pretty far out stuff.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's why it's, yeah, I don't want to be another face in the crowd. So I'm going to do this. And again, talking about population a little bit, just the huge population, it kind of stinks being faceless. And yeah, those little niche cultures are a way to have, I think, a much smaller, much more manageable, much, much closer community in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're part of this little niche culture, whatever it is. And so you might know all the people in the area who are also part of that group where there's no way you could know. You can't even really know all your neighbors if you live in one of those giant high rises, you know? So I think it's kind of a reaction to, I want to have connections with people and I want a smaller, much more manageable community around me.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think it's a really good point. And I'm glad you made it because when you said about the Lolita standing out in the sea of the black suits, but then the Loligoth is leaving that sea to join her own little lake.
Right.
You know, of other Loligoths, and then they kind of collect together. And the way Tokyo has, like, kind of taken this is in really, I suppose we could say creative directions in that you can have, like, apartment buildings that are geared towards motorcycle owners.
Mm-hmm.
Right, right.
And their motorcycle garage is actually attached to their apartment, even if that's on the 7th floor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They have a little mini garage with a clear wall where they can look at their motorcycle, as you would,
or have their quote unquote guests look at their motorcycle when they come over,
as you would, you know,
as you do, yeah.
Hey, let me just tell you, if I had a motorcycle, I would be showing that thing off all the time.
Or even in a smaller city like Osaka, we have two cats, and we looked at a pet apartment. Now, not like an apartment that is pet friendly, where you're allowed to have pets, but an apartment specifically geared towards pet owners.
Yeah, it's got this little glass wall in the garage where you can keep the cats.
Take a look at them. As you would.
No, I think I've seen commercials for that, or maybe you showed it to me, Lyle, and you kind of look at it and you say, wow, where's all the space for the people? You know, because a lot of it is devoted to, you know, with the cat thing, it was like cat toys and all this stuff, and I'm like, that doesn't look very comfortable. Not that much space for the humans.
You know, one of the things that kind of surprises me about the way Japanese culture deals with this is that even though there's such a strong social pressure to be homogenous, to be part of the standard culture, there's not a lot of reaction to people who go outside of it. The island I live on, it's got kind of fancy architecture. So every weekend we actually get quite a few cosplayers coming down here, taking pictures and hanging out and stuff. But I've had, an occasion to talk to them once or twice before, and they're pretty regular folks. If they're in a shop or something, the shopkeepers don't look at them or talk to them very strangely. They'll talk about them after they leave the shop. But, there's not the kind of reaction that I would expect, say, if this were back in the States.
Right. Well, again, I think that's kind of the cone of silence reaction to there are just so many people around here.
Yeah, and
I have to
put
that up as a defense mechanism because I've thought that too, you know, seeing like what I would consider strangely dressed people on the train. I remember when I used to work weekends, there would be like three girls who would get on my train who must have worked at like one of those Loligoth fashion stores because they came on in like the full Alice in Wonderland or Bo Peep outfits. And occasionally I would have people sit across from me and stare at me, the foreigner, who, in my opinion, looked pretty normal, but no one batted an eye at these three girls who look like they stepped out of, I don't know, some kind of weird Disney movie.
So the question is, what were you doing to get those people to stare at you?
Well, yeah, that's the other question. But from my perspective, it was nothing.
Yeah, so I mean, if you're talking about it from a game perspective, it's like, yeah, there are obstacles having a lot of people, but you can link up with like different cultures. And it's good that you can be dropping into the NPC. You have the person with all the connections. And it's like, yeah, I have an in with, like, let's say, the lowly goth. Probably a bad example.
Because we keep bringing it up. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, that person has an in, and that in, like, really extends through all the city. Mm-hmm. Because they all interact, and you can play that up.
I'm glad you brought that up, La, because right before you mentioned it, I was thinking Eclipse Phase and how you kind of have, yeah, all those different connection skills and you can make. And I guess a lot of games have, you know, a connection edge or a connection talent. And yeah, wouldn't that be cool to play in Tokyo where your connections aren't to like police or government or military or law enforcement or, you know, anything like that, which I guess is police, sorry. But instead your connections are to all these different subcultures, you know, and yeah, that would be, I think that'd be cool, either like a mystery or detective game or something where you're interacting with a lot of people, and that's a way to make every member of the team valuable. Mm. You know, you all have these different connections to these different subcultures, and between the 3, 4, or 5 of you, your contacts pretty much cover the entire city.
That's a really good point. And imagine, like, if you have to go and make contacts with, say, the Lollygoths. Yeah. All right, Frank, put on the tights.
There are other subcultures out there in Tokyo. You know?
Can we just downplay people's expectations on the Lollygoths?
Yeah. Sure.
There's a reason why they need to dress up.
Yeah, that's true.
I've never seen the Lollygoths go, damn.
I've seen some.
That girl's fine.
I've seen someone going, damn, why is she wearing that?
What the?
The other one's like, damn, how old is she? Or how old is she trying to look?
Yeah. Well, it looks like it's going to be a 2-part episode. We want to spend a little bit of time on our last heading of landscapes, where we'll actually cover different parts of Tokyo and talk about the things that you can do there and kind of define what the element is that you can incorporate into your game.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us for part one of Locations Tokyo. We'll pick it up next week with the second half of it. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com at redhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website or download it through DriveThruRPG or stream it through Stitcher or iTunes. You can post a comment right there on the website on the page or sign up and post in our forums because we have lots of wonderful discussions going on there. Or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter or just send us an email because we always love hearing from all of you. So thanks a lot and see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Sayonara.
DriveThruRPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG. The one true source for RPGs.
Oh!
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.